Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, founder of Yes to Life, the UK charity promoting the adoption of integrative medicine as a better way to care for people with cancer. As its name implies, integrative medicine integrates a wide range of nutritional, lifestyle and other supported therapies into mainstream conventional care to broaden choice and improve quality of life and outcomes. My guest this week is an impassioned advocate of integration, working to promote its adoption before Yes to Life was even thought of. Suzanne Ruggles is the founder and CEO of Full Circle, also a charity, that underpins her work at St George's Hospital in London and elsewhere. I'm speaking to Suzanne over the internet. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello, hello, Robin.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome you to the Yes to Life show. We've got plenty to talk about today. Most obviously is your fantastic work with Full Circle Charity that's been going for more than two decades, I think. Also, there's a brilliant current project I want to get into, which you're running at St George's. I'd definitely like to know a bit more about that. I hope we have time to fit in at least a look at that. But then behind all this is your own incredible backstory that provided the foundation for all of this. So you kindly sent me a copy of Coming Full Circle, A Journey to the Edge of Life and Back, the book you published in 2019. And I have to say, it's quite the most incredible back from the brink story that you're likely to read anywhere.
Wow.
I found it a compelling read and very inspiring. And one of the hugely striking features of your story is the before and after contrast, which is pretty stark. We'd like to just start out by describing the life that you were leading before your health started failing.
Yes. Well, thank you for that and a wonderful intro, Robin. Yes, well, the life I was leading before I actually got ill, I was an international designer, and I had galleries in the King's Road, more latterly and prior to that, Fulham Road. My clients were sort of heads of banks, heads of business, ambassadors, royalty. Guy Ritchie did my deliveries before he went to America to make movies. So I was... I'd taken on a building in the King's Road, about five floors of it, and just started to feel something going wrong with my health. I just thought it was stress. Eventually, I went to my GP. He said, I suspect it's just stress. And I said, please, can I have some tests? Because I don't recognise these symptoms. So I did get those tests. And the net result is I was diagnosed then, that was 96, with a condition, it's an autoimmune condition called lupus, or SLE. And seeing that a consultant for that, he again gave me a clue. He said 75% of illnesses that he saw as a neurologist, he said, are stress related. And he said, you've got to learn to manage your stress because the illness you have is exacerbated by stress. And if it gets out of control, you would not have very long before it becomes actually life critical. So I didn't really realize I was that stressed at that point. I mean, I must have been because I had quite a big business.
You've got to be doing all that.
Yeah. but I was young and I hadn't really thought about it, to be honest. Right. And so I said to him, what a fantastic idea. Okay, I'll schedule in stress management. How do I do that? Where do I start? And he said, I've got no idea. But he said, if you find out, let me know. So I was kind of given a clue, but left completely to the vagaries of trying to work it out. This was pretty much in the days before, really, well, it's 96, so the internet wasn't really a massive feature.
No.
So I didn't know where to go, and I really was stressed now by having this condition. So luckily, I got to and found my way to a few really good practitioners who were very sound, didn't give me weird advice, were very grounded in their practices, and taught me some things that I could do to help myself, which I think is really important, actually. We don't always... It's not always good to have things sort of done to us, help us relax because someone may give us a treatment that helps us relax or whatever it is, I think it's important that that person also learns some techniques for themselves. Right. And I got that. I received that and I was lucky to have that. So, and then I got the bug. I was like, wow, this is really, I don't know why, this is really exciting. I got really interested in the mind-body connection, how mind can be so busy, how that impacts on the body. And sort of along the way, I studied more and then started a degree in health psychology, which really does focus a lot on prevention, which I find I'm very drawn to. How can we help? How can we mitigate stress? Stress is around. It's huge, obviously, right now.
Absolutely.
In our current world with so much going on. It's very, very hard, probably impossible to say you've got to live a life without stress. It is then how we learn that dialogue between mind and body so that we don't automatically go into the fight flight response, which triggers a whole lot of physiological changes. So my journey took me, when I was doing my degree, took me to Harvard twice, studied the science of relaxation response, studied positive psychology, and then eventually I switched to a master's, which I did in St. George's Medical School. But sort of along the way, back in 2003, again, doing a lot, trying to build the project, because I then found myself, I had an opportunity, a very unusual opportunity to be in my local hospital, the place I'd actually tried to avoid going into when I was ill with my lupus, because I really tried my hardest to stay out of hospital and stay well and manage it, which I did very successfully, actually. But then I found myself with an opportunity to start a project in my local hospital, and that was on the hematology unit. And back in that period, so that was 2000, 2001, there was no psychological support for the hematology patients, which is the ward I was designated to be on. And I was really quite surprised at this because for those that may not know, hematology covers blood cancers, blood and lymphatic cancers. In many hospital environments, they include lymphatic cancers under hematology, not all, but lymphatic cancer patients would come to hematology for bone marrow transplant. And they are in isolation rooms, sealed isolation rooms, with very limited contact with their families. If they have little children, they're generally not allowed to come in because the infection risk is so great. The chemotherapy is directed at the bone marrow to take out the immune system fully. So they are rendered absolutely without an immune system for a period of time, which is called immune compromised. It takes out their clotting capability as well. So they're extraordinarily vulnerable and cut off. And even, I mean, I'm a huge sort of natural salad eater and, I want that sort of stuff. That sort of stuff is not allowed because there may be a pathogen on the washed lettuce and that alone could prove fatal. So they are left for typically 4 to 6 weeks, each round of chemo, each round. It goes well, and they're very, very, very ill for a lot of that period of time. Then they may go home for a week and then be readmitted for another 4 to 6, and this cycle, this is four times, and then if they're lucky, the whole thing will happen again for a transplant. So on and off, it's about a year. Really, on and off, you're in or out or on call to come in or frightened for your health or so on. So they had no support in place, no psychological support.
Amazing. It's just like a prison sentence with a bit of torture thrown in.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. The nurses, I have to say, they clocked very quickly that I had some therapy skills in my toolbox, if you like. And because the project I was there to do was not at all to do with therapies, it was a combination of nurses saying, oh, you've got this extra skill set and we need this, and can you make it happen? Now, of course, this was the NHS in 2001, which is not like the NHS currently, because the NHS currently, in terms of actually understanding the need for complementary therapies, is the thinking has come on a lot, shall we say. I think there's a lot of room for improvement, but it's come on a lot. But then it was very, very, very really unheard of. So I began that in 2001 in earnest. It started and it moved very quickly. But then I came up against a lot of red tape. Some of which is I completely understand. It's about protecting very vulnerable patients with the practitioner that you may be bringing in, or practitioners. But some of it is just interminable. And as I say, my background in business, you know, you get from A to B,
right,
and you obviously have a lot of governance checks and balances and that sort of thing, but you never lose sight that very, very soon you need to get to B. Whereas sort of in the NHS, that business mindset is not the same. And so it can be difficult. But the way I found is there are what I call gatekeepers. Gatekeepers are anybody in the trust who makes happen what has to happen. And they are typically, for me, nurses, have always been nurses. And sometimes they're doctors. Sometimes they are the ward clerk, the receptionist. It is amazing. They're there. These are really amazing people who've never forgotten they're in the NHS for the point of the patient, and don't let unnecessary red tape get in the way.
The heroes of the NHS, eh?
They are the unsung heroes. Gosh, that's a whole nother subject I'd love to talk about, because my gosh, they come in unusual guises and amazing guises. And they can sometimes just be the facilities man who clocks, just he's about to go off on duty, but there's a call from the ward, you know, the heating's gone off, the person's now being blasted with air, say, you know, aircon or something, it's too cold, and they've got a weekend ahead of them, and you know, he comes up and he sorts it in his own time to make sure it's done for that patient, so they don't have to work. These things, it is populated by really amazing people like that, but I search them out. And then in 2003, I was wading through the red tape. The project was moving. We had practice and, again, started to feel not very well, thought it might have been a flu, didn't know what it was. And then I got worse and worse and worse and went to my GP twice in one day. And by the end of the day, I was starting to sort of dip into unconsciousness, or something weird was going on. I was hallucinating. Amazing. I just wanted to sleep. An immense headache, being very, very ill, violently ill. And I just wanted to sleep and hopefully it'll all be gone in the morning. What it turned out to be was meningitis. And it turned out to be bacterial meningitis, which is the most deadly sort. And talking about gatekeepers, there was an amazing young junior doctor on the ward, in the haematology ward. And again, I clocked her special. No faff, no fluff, just got it for her patients, just made things move for her patients. And I and another consultant spoke about her once. She's like, she's special. She's a really incredibly brilliant scientific, if you like, doctor, but she's absolutely intuitive about what the need is. Anyway, my mother was on the phone to my then fiance, and my mother's GP had already, she'd contacted him, and he said, your daughter sounds like she's got meningitis. Tell her to get to hospital. By that point, it was too hard. My light sensitivity meant I couldn't have any light near me, and I couldn't even get down the stairs. The pressure in my head was now too great. So I just said to my fiance, no, I can't do it. It's all too blimmin' hard. I'm just going to go to sleep. And I, you know, it can't be that. I don't get things like that. You know, it's not for me. I'll deal with it in the morning. And so I fell asleep.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with ZeroZilchZip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit ZeroZilchZip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And in the middle of my sleep, I was woken up with a jolt almost of an insistent message. Ring the ward. It was like someone sort of kind of staring in your face and saying, do something. It was like that, but it, you know, kind of coming as a message, sort of, I don't know. But it woke me up and I was like, oh God, I can't. I just, no, it's too, no, the time has passed for that. I can't do that. And this insistent message, as if it was in my face, was like, ring the ward now. And it just wouldn't go away. And I went, well, all right then. So I rang the ward and was imagining there might be a nurse. It was 9 o'clock at night, nurse on shift. Obviously not that many people around at 9 o'clock. I just knew how it worked. She'd have to try and find someone. She'd have to try and explain to them. She's busy. She's got 13 or 14 patients. It's all going to take too long. I don't want to bother her. If anything. So anyway, I rang the ward. And who should pick up the phone but this young doctor who shouldn't have been there at 9 o'clock at night. And I just said, oh, Jane, just tell me I'll be all right in the morning. And she heard enough, literally, not much, that I told her. And she said, Susie, get in now. And I went, oh, no, Jane, you're not supposed to say that. And she said, now. And I said, look, Jane, I can't sit in A&E. I can't hack the light. I'm sorry. I just can't. She said, I will find you a darkened room. I will meet you at the entrance. We'll go straight into a darkened room. You have my word. Are you leaving? And I went, okay. Knowing that I really respected her as well, and I just thought, she's not going to leave me hanging around for hours in A&E. So with that, I somehow managed to get down the stairs, and we got to the hospital and did everything illegal you're not supposed to do. We used the ambulance pathway and this, that, and the other, but just got in. You know, my fiance just knew time was literally of the essence. So sort of I went out with my big black winter coat over my head and just followed my feet, basically walked in, and she was there. She took me into a darkened room, but with a small torch she could see. I had already septicemia. I had the small the sort of little red spots, and so she didn't wait. She just put two lines of antibiotics in and then told Jean, if Susie come in an hour later, it would have been too late to save her. But we don't know. It's going to take a few days to know if the antibiotics will work or not. So that was that, really. But at that point, that was 2003, from my first diagnosis in 96, I had learned a lot. I had learned a lot about how I could help myself, help my body be in as calm a place as possible when you know you're facing the end. And I absolutely knew I was facing the end. I knew I had to stay as calm as possible. I had to keep hope alive, which was hard, but I knew that was important. But I knew that more than likely I would die. And in that night, I, when that realization really hit me, Robin, I was bereft, and I'm going probably to get a bit teary, and it never ends me feeling teary at the concept, the memory of it. I was pretty certain that was it, and I was certain that the project that I've been building up since 2001 to just literally only 2 years, was nowhere near what I knew was possible in the way of helping patients, supporting them at their lowest, ironically, as I was feeling myself at that point. I knew that it's very, very hard for a nurse, doctor, anyone in the NHS already with their workload to try to piece the project together like I had imagined. And I just knew it was going to die with me, or be a pale version of what I felt was possible. And I was really, really, really upset, and then became really, really focused, a bit like on Dragon's Den. I basically kind of sold to the power that be above. I don't want to impose what, because everyone's understandings of the bigger picture are different or whatever. So, you know, to something higher, call it like that. I appealed and I said, please help me. I am not ready to die. But I understand that I really don't have a choice in this. If I am being kind of called home, in inverted commas, who am I to say, sorry, I'm not actually going to do that. But then I, like in the Dragon's Den, I was like, this is what I am doing. This is what I can do, want to do, have to set up, and this is why. And I was imagining some of the patients on the ward, on the haematology unit, who I'd said I'd go back to see and then hadn't because I've got ill. And before I knew it, I was floating on the ward. I was there. Mm. No one saw me, but my mind was there, and I was there, and it was as if I was there. It was light. The lights were on. The buzzers were going. People were going around. Nurses hear that everywhere. And so I just pointed to using my mind, you see, in this patient, and the need is great here, and the need is great here, and there's so much need. And then before I knew it, I was back in my body, back in the room, off in A&E. And I said, but if you're calling me home, please help me, because I don't know how to die. Who does at the end of the day? But that's where I was at. And it felt to me like I would be literally expected to walk off a cliff. And I am not brave enough to do that. And I just didn't know how to do it. And I just said, please help me. But, you know, guys up there, I am really, if I've got a choice, you know what I want. I want to stay. I need to finish this. And at that moment, Robin, all I can describe it as is a wave of unconditional love. I can't explain it any way more than that. It is miles more than the biggest love we've ever, 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 ever felt in this world. It is light. It is light filled. It is just beautiful. Anyway, it came through me, sort of somehow from through my head, through me. It came definitely through my head, from my head first. And it's like a waterfall of light and love. And it just was soothing and reassuring and calming and just light and love filled. And there was nothing else than that, but that's huge. But in that, I knew I was being heard. And I didn't know what the actual answer was, whether I was going to be helped to live or helped to die. But I knew I was being heard. And at that point, that was all I needed. And the next day, Jane, actually, Dr. Evans, did come into, and I got moved onto another ward, and she came, and she, I remember she sat by me, and she just said, and it's truthful, she said, you are terribly, terribly unwell. The inflammation in your brain is immense. We don't know what will happen. We've just got to hope the antibiotics work. The best advice I can give you is not move. don't sneeze, don't strain, don't lift your head, just don't move, and hope that you won't get brain damage. But she said, you know, you're just there, you're teetering, words to that effect. And so there I was. And so to cut a long story short, I was not doing very well with the pain, but I didn't want to sort of ramp up my pain medication because I was already hallucinating. So I took as little painkiller as I could, but it wasn't helping me sleep. So I eventually asked for more painkillers one night because I was desperate to sleep after about 7 days of no sleep. And my body had a massive reaction to the pain medication, and it just went into a sort of frenzy of vomiting. Sorry if people are listening to this, I do apologize, but it was uncontrollable. My body was like, I don't want painkillers, and that's that. And that was way too much pressure for my brain. And suddenly the room curved and sounds, and it went green, and I started hieroglyphs on the wall, and it was very frightening, actually. And then I started leaving my body, and I was all the while like a really insistent terrier saying, I'm not ready to leave. And I've got this, I know how to ground, I've been doing this for years, I can ground. And I just imagined trees, couldn't get back in my body. And I kept going up and up and up. And I won't spoil it for anyone who might be interested to read the book, but something quite miraculous actually happened the moment I was out of options. And I guess it's obvious, I was desperate to live, but there was a point I was beyond exhausted at this point, and the futility, I just couldn't do it anymore. And I gave up. And at that point, something happened that brought me back. And a couple of days later, literally, I mean, it was a miraculous thing, and it was a miraculous recovery. It was a spontaneous and miraculous recovery. It was extraordinary. It's all in my notes, so it's all there. And anyway, so a few days later, I was just lying on my bed in the hospital room waiting to be discharged home. And I got a vision, just a little, you know, like we do, like a daydream vision, I suppose, of a little ship, a little boat, actually, a little sailing boat, moving very strongly in a wind from right to left. And on the right, there was this enormous, dark, foreboding cloud. And this little sailing boat, little one, had come out from that storm. And it was tacking. And it was as if we're in England, it was like it was going west, but, you know, who knows, whatever. And it seemed very obvious it had its destination. And it was very focused. And at that moment, the words full circle came. The name of the project, because it didn't have a name at this point, was Full Circle. And it was very clear this project was going to be called Full Circle. And I have fought rather hard to make sure we kept that name because of where it came from and how it came. And there it was, a kind of a beautiful, incredible contract.
Absolutely.
Perhaps is a word. I've never used that word before about it, but it, I guess it is. And it's a willingly given and willingly accepted contract to make sure Full Circle does materialize, really. And it has.
Right. So you had to live up to your determination to make it happen that you'd expressed.
Yes. But even more than that, it was knowing how it came about. It has come about in such an incredible way that it feels supported at some level, some higher level, if that makes sense. And it's I've often said to my team, Full Circle is an incredible thing because it attracts the right people to it, and it repels those whose sort of intentions are different and don't have to be wrong. They're just different. And it sort of holds a space for people to find us to do the work. It's very special.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
I just wanted to explore one thing from what you said. There were a phrase that got used quite a lot in the early days of Yesterlife was trust in Allah, but tie your camel well.
Yes.
And I think it sounds to me like you've got your camel very well tied with your sheer determination to want to stay alive. But actually, the trust in Allah bit was what happened at the moment that you let go.
Yeah.
Is that, would you say that was true?
Yes. Beautiful. Yes, absolutely. And that is unforgettable. What happened from that moment of trust, if you like. But I love that, Robin, actually. Yeah, we can't be sort of too dreamy about this. You know, we are here and we have really, if we're in the NHS, a really serious task ahead of us. That means there are so many elements that mean that camel, if you like, has to be incredibly well tied.
Yeah, we have to do our bit, but there are two sides to it, aren't there? It doesn't matter what we do in the end, there's something bigger happening as well.
Yes.
So we have to account for both. Yeah. Okay, well look, now you've got to Full Circle. You better tell us now about Full Circle, what it is, what it does. It's not going to have to be the long version because we haven't got so much time left, but yes, please.
Sure. So, well, what Full Circle does is provide complementary therapies, integrative therapies at the point of need for patients with life-limiting conditions. As you know, the project started in haematology in 2006. I was asked to take over and build a project for oncology, which had been running with a palliative care nurse who was doing her best, but in her sort of spare time to run it. And then I was also asked in 2006 to set up a project for paediatric medicine, which was the first of its kind in the UK. So we focus where there is a life-limiting or life-threatening condition and using complementary therapies, using them as the first and important point of access to someone who has recently been given a very serious diagnosis, knowing from my own experience the turmoil that that engenders, and being that first sort of access point to say to that person and that person's body, that mind-body connection, come back to your breath. We use therapies like reflexology, touch therapies. Touch is so, so important, so underestimated in a highly clinical environment, so important. It is understood by the body, you know, therapeutic touch. It can lower the heart rate, lower anxiety, bring about a sense of calmness. We also use energetic therapy. So we have a lovely project for where we've introduced formerly Reiki, and through this project. Was a three-year project. It's just continuing for a little bit longer, but we've partnered with the Mayo Clinic in America, who've had Reiki for about 7 years in their oncology unit, brought in a wonderful practitioner who's medically trained clinical hypnotherapy practitioner, also mindfulness. She does, did a beautiful, important and valuable piece of work for head and neck cancer patients who were pretty much abandoned by the clinical care after they had necrosing jaw and couldn't eat and were, you know, peg fed, etc. And we did this absolutely incredible piece of work. She won an award for at a European conference. our Reiki work won an award for at the same European clinical conference. Sorry, I think I may have said that the clinical hypnotherapy project for head and neck cancers, that was at a European cancer surgery conference. So we are there with therapies, adapting them to the need of the patient. Our youngest patient currently is a few weeks old. And we have a massage therapy, of course, as well as part of the touch therapy. So we evaluate where we can. If we can't evaluate, it's very difficult to really evaluate a tiny baby. So we find other ways, case studies, etc. So we're very big at looking at how we can evaluate. Ultimately, my aim is we want this approach, what I would call the full circle of care. It's not looking at a person as a bunch of cells that have gone wrong that need chemotherapy or whatever. This is a person here who is dealing with an awful lot at that point. So it's that full circle of care, just finding a way to support them and then help them. Breathing techniques, visualizations, and also the touch therapies, as I've mentioned. And we are in St. George's Hospital, been there since I started the project in 2001. So, yeah, just two decades, 21 years. We are also now in the University Hospital of Sussex, Brighton, on the cancer unit there with one of my former leads from St. George's. And we seed funded that. And that's been wonderful. It's been taken over by their cancer fund and they're funding her. We've just recently started at Princess Royal in Haywards Heath. With the same organisation, and hopefully for them also we'll be setting up a wonderful project for them at Worthing Hospital. My vision back when was that this needs to be in every hospital, and my aim now is to really help hospitals who haven't got access to this, and knowing how very hard it is to set up something and where do you find really good practitioners and how do you manage the governance and the security and the all the other elements that are needed. I want to really try to help these other trusts do that for their areas.
Very important. Yeah. Well, I've got a real sense of a kind of wealth of information and experience you've got from your more than two decades doing this. And you're right. You need to spread that around and make sure as many people have access to it as possible. One of the features of the whole introduction of complementary therapies into oncology units is it's been universally on the back of charities such as yours. Do you envisage a day when actually you'll see actually this is just as important part of healthcare as everything else and should be paid for?
Absolutely. That's one of the big areas of focus I've got.
Good.
And that goes hand in hand with evaluating the service. There are some I understand that already are. I was quite cheered. I did a little piece of work recently. I was quite cheered. There are some surprising newcomers into the world of providing complementary therapies. Trusts across the country that I was really surprised at who are now moving. And so I don't know how they're finding the money. It could well be from their charities. Every hospital has a hospital charity. The amounts are we're talking in the millions of income that they have. And there was one fantastic model when I first started was the Christie Hospital in Manchester. And back then I was looking at how they were funding their team. Mm-hmm. And they were using their hospital charity and had, I don't know, whatever, 13 million incoming. That's nice, summer money. And they made a commitment back then, this was talking 2002 and three, of a quarter of their incoming into the hospital charity was designated patient care. And that encompasses certainly complementary therapies, but it also encompasses everything from the wig person, maybe, you know, all these other areas. But that is a proper commitment. And Worthing Hospital, well, the trust, which is Brighton Foundation, University Hospital, Sussex Foundation Trust, they're wonderful. And that's why I'm so pleased to have a project there. They're ahead of it as well. And with their Worthing Trust, I think they are looking at a third of their incoming is going to be to well-being, which of course has become the big word since COVID. And I believe that's the way it has to be. Right. And that incoming can pass money to the hospital to fund these practitioners. So the hospital, the NHS, isn't having to use it out of, say, a nursing budget. You know, that already is really, really tough for the NHS to cope with, you know, sort of quite tight, very tight nursing budgets. So it's, you know, putting on my business hat. That's how you do it. You find another way around it that is effortless. Happy patients donate back to that hospital charity. We have one of my very first patients donated. He passed away. He wanted a significant amount of his money to come. This was before Full Circle was set up. So he bequeathed his flat actually to the ward fund where I'd worked. He said, I want it for patients and I want it for staff. And I never ever forgot that, because he was not wrong. If you actually only support patients, well, you're doing a fantastic job, absolutely, but you have to support staff. I've always said this, and I am really banging on about it now. After COVID, those that are still there, because a lot have left, are on their knees, and they need us and our help. You know, they don't need clapping and, you know, whatever. They really do need, and, you know, we're part of that. So that is another project I'm working on.
Well, look, we're nearly out of time. I want you to just tell me what you're doing with the St. George's University Hospital Foundation Trust to do with staff, because you've got a project on the go at the moment. And we may have to have another interview in order to go into it a bit more. But anyway, at least tell us what you're doing.
Yes. Well, it's very, very hot off the press, actually, and it's not yet formalised, signed off. But the project came from, so I lecture in St. George's University, the medical school, and from my work there, one of the deans approached me and said, can you do something for student, medical student, paramedic, you know, all the healthcare professional students that are going through St. George's, can you come up with some support projects, programs for them? So I started developing this, brought in one of my trustees who's a former physician from the Mayo, she's in America, and we built this. And as we were building it for the university, I was like, this needs to be offered to staff. So I am working my way now at a very high level. The trust MD, who is the head of the trust, is really supportive, and she's new in post. And I say, watch this space. We are looking at a range of things. One of them I'm looking at is heart math, which is using heart rate variability and an objective measure to help each person through a breath work to the heart reach a state of coherence, which is the most healthy state for someone to be in. So I can talk more about that. So I'm looking at introducing heart math, but we're looking at I'm proposing a day a week for the next year. That's a commitment that we're looking for staff to be able to come and get access to our therapies. We also have a professor, former professor of medicine from the Mayo, who's a resilience expert, lectured at NASA, published in over 30 peer-reviewed journals, scientific base of resilience, looking to offer that. So that's the sort of thing. So really, mind-body, back to my original understanding. Wow. You help one, you help the other. Well, and we need to do it for staff.
If anything changes healthcare for patients, it'll be giving staff an experience of what it could do for them.
Yeah, so, spot on.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
So look, I'm going to round off with a quote from your book, which I lifted out of there. It says, in my view, illness holds within it the seed of opportunity to reconnect not only to ourselves, but to the infinite. As my friend and founding patient ambassador of Full Circle Fund Therapies, Eric Evans, once said, in the moment of something awful are the seeds for something wonderful. However, will you recognise what it is? And most importantly, what will you do about it? So as a great message, I feel that. I wondered if you'd just like to make one comment on that to finish us off.
Oh, well, that's beautiful that you've picked that up. I think there is the opportunity for us. You know, illness is a terrible, terrible thing that happens to us, and we would all like to wake up and live to our fullest selves without illness. But actually, sometimes illness, if we spin it around, it is an opportunity, and can be an opportunity, I think, to reconnect with what is our strength, which is back to ourselves and through the breath, through the body. It is an incredible gift that we have. And sometimes it's very hard for people to access that immediately, but that's the step. But I love Eric's quote. It starts to open us up to, okay, what is the opportunity? What could we find as an opportunity in this absolutely horrific environment of being very, very ill, or having a loved one who's very, very ill? It is a challenge for sure to find that, but there is a gift somewhere. And it might be a small seed and we don't yet notice it, but keep looking.
Well, you clearly found yours, so that's amazing. Great story. Thank you so much, Suzanne. Really enjoyed hearing all about it today. I recommend your book as a great read. And I think we've probably got more to talk about another time.
Thank you, Robin. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah. Thanks, Suzanne.
Take care.
Find out more about Suzanne and her work at fullcirclefund.org.uk, and if you'd like to know more about her book, she has her own website at suzanne-ruggles.com, and that's Suzanne with a Z, dash Ruggles, R-U-G-G-L-E-S.com. Yes to Life has a really practical and informative online panel event on June the 11th called Natural Ways to Deal with Common Side Effects, which will feature a stellar lineup of experts to answer every question. You can book your place now at the rock bottom early bird price of just £15, so it's really accessible. To find out more, go to yestolife.org.uk and click the Find Out More button that's in the banner at the top of the homepage. Thanks for listening today. Hope you'll join me again next week for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.